February 10, 2007, Springfield, Illinois. A first-term senator with a foreign-sounding name announced his presidential bid from the old state capital, where Abraham Lincoln once warned that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The symbolism was unmistakable. Barack Obama was positioning himself as the bridge between America's bloodiest chapter and its most audacious hope, that race might finally cease to define destiny. Critics dismissed him as too young, too inexperienced, too different. Yet within 2 years, he would stand on those same steps taking the oath of office, becoming the first African-American president in a nation built partly on slave labor. How does a biracial child abandoned by his father, raised by white grandparents in Hawaii, transform into the leader of the free world? The answer lies not in political maneuvering alone, but in a profound journey of identity, one that mirrors America's own struggle to reconcile its founding ideals with its painful history. On March 7, 1965, 25-year-old John Lewis led 600 peaceful protesters across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, demanding voting rights. State troopers attacked with nightsticks and tear gas, fracturing Lewis's skull. ABC broadcast the violence to 48 million Americans. 8 days later, President Johnson declared, "Their cause must be our cause," concluding with, "We shall overcome." On March 4, 2007, Obama arrived at Brown Chapel in Selma, just 1 month into his presidential campaign. As the only African-American candidate without deep civil rights credentials, he needed to claim his inheritance. He offered something more intangible than Hillary Clinton's legislative record, a complex, thoughtful black man who embodied the promise that Selma's blood had purchased. Obama challenged the Joshua generation, those who inherited the Moses generation's freedom, for their poverty of ambition, while calling for personal responsibility. The day concluded with Obama pushing Fred Shuttlesworth's wheelchair across that same bridge where Lewis had bled. The torch had passed. Barack Obama Sr. arrived in America in 1959 through a program conceived by Kenyan labor leader Tom Maboya. When British authorities rejected it as more political than educational, Maboya turned to American supporters. Jackie Robinson, Sidney Poitier, and Harry Belafonte helped fund the airlift. By 1963, these students filled 70% of upper echelon posts in post-colonial Kenya. Obama Sr.'s story was more complex than the goat herder son narrative. His father, Hussein Onyango Obama, worked as a cook for white Britons in Nairobi and was middle class by African standards. During the Mau Mau Rebellion, British authorities arrested and tortured Onyango for suspected anti-colonial activities, a trauma that rippled through generations. Barack Sr. was brilliant but reckless. Expelled from school, he married 16-year-old Kezia and left her pregnant when he departed for Hawaii. He met Anne Dunham in a Russian language course and married her without mentioning his first wife. When Harvard offered him a scholarship in 1962, he chose prestige over family, leaving Anne and baby Barack behind, an abandonment that haunted his son for decades. Stanley Ann Dunham inherited restlessness from her father, Stanley Armour Dunham, whose mother's suicide when he was 8 set him adrift across Depression-era America. He married Madeline Lee Payne, a studious Methodist girl, a union her parents considered scandalous. By 1955, the family reached Mercer Island, Washington. While peers obsessed over sock hops and Elvis, Anne embraced jazz, foreign films, and progressive politics. At Mercer Island High, teachers introduced Marx, Margaret Mead, and debates about God's existence. When school board chairman John Stenhouse faced the House Subcommittee on Un-American Activities for past communist ties, Anne witnessed McCarthyism's destructive power firsthand. Senior year brought another upheaval, a move to Hawaii, crushing Anne's plans for the University of Washington or Chicago. In Honolulu, she met Barack Obama Sr., drawn to his intelligence and confidence. By December 1960, she was pregnant. They married quietly on Maui in February 1961. At 20, Anne became a single mother when Obama Sr. chose Harvard over family. Her dream of adventure had become survival. Barack Hussein Obama Jr. was born August 4, 1961, in Honolulu. His father left for Harvard when Barack was barely a year old. After divorcing Obama Sr., Anne married Indonesian geologist Lolo Sitoro, moving six-year-old Barry to Jakarta in 1967. While Anne taught liberal humanist values, Lolo taught survival boxing for self-defense and the harsh realities of power. Anne woke him at 4 a.m. daily for supplementary English lessons, preparing him for his eventual return to America. After fourth grade, Barry returned to Hawaii to live with grandparents he barely knew. Through Stanley's connections, he gained admission to prestigious Punahou School, where he faced immediate culture shock. Kids laughed at his name and asked if his father was a cannibal. Among 3,500 students, only three or four were Black. Obama and his few Black friends grappled with profound questions. Were they Black first or individuals first? His 2004 convention speech about eradicating the idea that if a Black kid has a book, he's acting white, directly reflected these high school conversations. Basketball became Obama's salvation, a space where he met Black soldiers, exposing him to their language and style. As his brother-in-law Craig Robinson noted, he didn't know who he was until he found basketball. It was the first time he really met Black people. Stanley also introduced him to Frank Marshall Davis, an aging poet who warned that even sympathetic whites could never fully comprehend a Black man's pain, conversations that shaped Obama's understanding of race in America. At Occidental College, Obama moved fluidly between social groups while forging his identity. His sophomore year roommate, wealthy Pakistani radical Mohammad Hassan Chando, helped shape his progressive ideals. During this period, he transitioned from Barry to Barack, a shift friend Caroline Boss saw as connecting to his father's legacy. He had this sense of his father as a man of destiny. After transferring to Columbia, Obama entered his ascetic period, wandering New York, visiting Harlem churches, socialist conferences, and jazz clubs. "I was like a monk," he later recalled. In 1985, he accepted a community organizing position in Chicago, arriving just after Harold Washington's historic election as the city's first Black mayor. Working with Jerry Kelman in the Saul Alinsky tradition, Obama lived with monk-like discipline. At Altgeld Gardens public housing project, when Linda Randall discovered workers removing asbestos only from administrative offices, Obama organized residents to confront the Chicago Housing Authority. The mass meeting descended into chaos, a humiliating failure that taught him lessons about power and organizing no classroom could provide. Obama arrived at Harvard Law School in fall 1988, seeking power's currency to bring back like Promethean fire to communities like Altgeld. Friends called him the interpreter for seamlessly shifting tone, connecting equally with white Harvard professors, Black friends from the inner city, and bank presidents. When Obama became the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review, another Black student grabbed and hugged him hard. Obama realized it was more than just about me, it was about us. His historic election made worldwide headlines, though he cautioned, "It's important that stories like mine aren't used to say that everything is okay for Blacks." Rather than pursuing corporate law, Obama joined a civil rights firm in Chicago. In spring 1992, he led Project Vote, registering nearly 150,000 new voters. At the press conference, he strategically let established politicians take credit, impressing Democratic operatives with his political savvy. The Jeremiah Wright controversy tested Obama severely. On March 18, 2008, he delivered his pivotal A More Perfect Union speech in Philadelphia, empathizing with both his embittered preacher and frustrated white workers, a high-stakes balancing act only he could pull off. His Iowa caucus victory proved he could win white votes in the whitest of states, making a Black presidency suddenly possible. On January 20, 2009, Barack Obama was sworn in as the 44th president. Spotting John Lewis, the only surviving speaker from the 1963 March on Washington, Obama embraced him. The circle was complete, from Selma's blood to the White House steps. Obama replaced Winston Churchill's bust in the Oval Office with busts of Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. The bridge Obama represented wasn't just between Black and white America, it was between the ideals America proclaimed and the reality it had lived. Your own life is a bridge, too. What divides are you willing to cross?